Good morning. Averting environmental crisis is the work of ecologist and cancer survivor Sandra Steengraber. She's in Honolulu this week. We'll talk with her this morning. Changing Hawaii's educational policy is the substance of a far-reaching omnibus bill the Hawaii State Teachers Association says it will introduce. HSTA President Corey Rosenly joins us with a preview. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. We'll have Streetlight Cadence performing live in our studio, looking ahead to the band's weekend Atherton studio performance. And Maui-based novelist Arlie Holmes sets out to inspire with Daddy Will Fix It.
It's Monday, December 14th. Those conversations and a few more coming up this hour. But first, this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation for a Monday, December 14th. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Looking at the way if we poison our environment, we're very likely poisoning ourselves, yeah?
And there have been a lot of studies which have brought up just that issue.
Sure.
And one of the women who has been pushing a lot of the conversation about that is Dr. Sandra Steengraber. For her, the nexus of environmental pollution and cancer is personal. She's a cancer survivor as well as a biologist. One of her books, Living Downstream, An Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer in the Environment, brings together data on toxic releases with data from U.S. cancer registries. The book was adapted for the screen in 2010. These days, Dr. Steengraber writes and speaks extensively about fracking. This week, she will be in Honolulu, and for the next few minutes, she'll be with us by phone from New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. One of the things that you've said is that what runs in families does not necessarily run in blood, and our genes are less an inherited set of teacups enclosed in a cellular china cabinet than they are plates used in a busy diner. What do you mean when you say that regarding how people sometimes look at their inheritance genetically and want to lay a lot of blame in that way?
Right. So the first question, of course, that all of us who are cancer patients are asked is to describe our family history of cancer. And so I think the lesson that people take away from that line of questioning is that cancer must run in our genes. And cancer is genetic. It is caused by genetic injury. But what we know is that most of those genetic injuries are caused during our lifetime to bad things that happen to our genes, not to the genes that we inherit. And my own awareness of this came very personally. I was diagnosed with bladder cancer at age 20, and I became a co-cancer patient with my own mother, who had been diagnosed just a couple years earlier with metastatic breast cancer in her 40s. And my aunt went on then to die of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. I went on to develop colon lesions. My cousin also has stage 3 colon cancer now, and so on. But I'm adopted, and that's the punchline to my family history. I'm not related to any of the people I just mentioned by genes, but we did all grow up in the same area. So that became my work when I was a biologist in my 30s. I went back to my hometown and investigated the cancer cluster of which I am one data point within, and discovered toxic chemicals in my hometown drinking water and so forth and so on. And so I think that looking at the ways in which the chemicals to which we're exposed can cause genetic injury is a meaningful place to begin a program of cancer prevention, because after all, there's nothing we can do about our ancestors, whether we know who they are, as most people do, or in my case, as an adoptee, I don't. But we can do everything about the chemicals that we put into the environment through direct action, through policy, through consumer choices, and so forth. So that my work as a biologist is directed along those lines.
You've just come back from being in Paris, And we were all watching and listening to all the reports coming out of the climate summit. What is the intersection of what you saw happen in Paris, or perhaps what you didn't see happen in Paris, that gave you either great pause or feeling that maybe we're on the right path?
I think that what happened in Paris is very hopeful. It changes the narrative. I mean, it's very clear from the treaty that came out, and I watched it day by day for 2 weeks as various passages and proposals were either shot down or included or made it in or were eliminated and so forth. And I feel that it gives us a document to which we can appeal, and it, even though the plans in place are modest now, there is a ratchet mechanism that requires nation states to deepen their commitment as time goes by to bring us to a target of 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is the limit that we can have before island states and island nations begin to go underwater, before we lose all the ice sheets, and even before the plankton itself in the ocean are in trouble. And, of course, plankton provide us more than half the oxygen we breathe. So right now we're on a terrible trajectory. This agreement gives us a way to move off that trajectory, but it is, you know, look, there are no UN police, right? We're going to come to all these different nations and make sure that their emissions go down and make sure that the plans are in place. So the other half of this has to be absolute involvement and activism on the part of civil society to actually implement the vision that the Paris Accord provides for us. So the work, the real work now begins, but I think we've been given a huge assist by the United Nations, and part of that assist comes in the clear signal that it sends to the business and the financial community that the age of fossil fuels is now over and it's going to be sunsetted. And so really investment dollars need to be directed to renewable energy lines, down these lines and pathways that will allow us essentially to go on what I see as a hostage rescue mission to take out of the alternative energy world, you know, the solar panels, the batteries, all this really good technology that's been on the sidelines that needs to become the new normal way of doing things. That can only happen once we direct investment dollars in those pathways. And that's, I think, the true value of this accord. I actually, you know, I'm a biologist. That's what my PhD is in, but I make my living as a science writer. So I was actually there with my writer hat on. I had a press pass, mm-hmm. which gave me access to all kinds of different venues. And I spent a lot of time actually talking to the CEOs and the financiers and the investors and attending these, you know, $1,000 a ticket summits. And I felt absolute confidence on their part that they have the tools and the solutions, but they're looking for a strong political signal that, you know, investment dollars can flow in that direction.
And they haven't seemed to have gotten that political signal via all the conversation and all the attention that's been placed on it to date. And you know, with that and what we've just been talking about, do you see that what you have initially, or what initially got you involved with advocacy and environmentalism, is perhaps not getting as much of attention as the issue of climate change and what we need to do to be able to counter it?
Oh, these things are all connected, you know. So I'll be talking when I come to Honolulu about pesticides, which is the work that I, you know, began so many years ago. It's partly what I wrote my dissertation on and so forth and so on. But these are chemicals that are made from petroleum. They're made from natural gas. And in some cases, they're created to solve a waste disposal problem that our fossil fuel industry has. And so if we can get ourselves off of fossil fuels, we also, one of the hostages we free up, if I can use that metaphor, mm-hmm. is organic agriculture. And that's really going to be what I talk about when I'm there. The problem that we have with overabundance of cheap pesticides, all of which are made from fossil fuels, because many, you know, fossil fuels are extracted out of the ground and they're not lit on fire, but rather they serve to become building blocks for petrochemicals, some of which are used in agriculture, and that also drives What's happening now in Hawaii is it's used as an experimental station for genetically modified organisms. So I want to make in my talk connections between the GMO issue, the pesticide issue, and the evidence we have linking it to birth defects and cancer, and then more recently this focus on how these things are connected to climate change.
All right, we're going to leave it there, and we wish you a good trip coming here from New York. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Sandra Steingraber is a biologist, author, and cancer survivor. She is currently a distinguished scholar in residence at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York, and this Wednesday we'll be speaking in Honolulu. Details are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, tuning up for a streetlight cadence performance. But first, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, a valley you may have visited, one of the most beautiful in the islands. Its name in Hawaiian means curved water. It's surrounded by cliffs that rise 2,000 feet from the valley floor. You can reach the valley floor by a steep road, one of the steepest you may ever take. In fact, it's a four-wheel drive vehicle only road, and it drops 800 vertical feet in just about half a mile at a 25% average grade, with steeper grades in various sections. It's the steepest road of its kind in the United States, as a matter of fact, and you might be thinking about that as you descend into the valley. Once you're there, though, you'll see a range of spectacular sights well worth the trip, including a beautiful black sand beach and a waterfall that inspired a classic Hawaiian song. It's in the southernmost and largest of the seven windward valleys of Kohala Mountain, sometimes called the Valley of the Kings, and this morning we're looking for its name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right will get the t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Regina from St. Andrew's Priory. You're listening to HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Streetlight Cadence is still a young band, but they've seen a lot of changes in the 6 years they've been together, a trajectory that has taken them from street performance to the concert hall and the recording studio. Jonathan Franklin is lead singer and guitarist for the band, which is performing in our Atherton studio this weekend. He's here with Brian Webb, cellist for the band, to give us a preview of that concert. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having us.
You guys have really been on a ride almost from the beginning, yeah?
Yeah, when you start off on the sidewalks, everything is to perform and play and make money on the sidewalks, and it's been an uphill ever since.
Yeah, well, you don't have to worry about ending up on the street, do you?
Oh, we always are on the street. We'll stay there probably for some time.
You know, it's a whole different path to getting out there to a musical audience for your generation, don't you think? I mean,
I've heard of some great musicians who started off on the sidewalks, mm-hmm. and I don't think we're the first people to do it at all. And in fact, it's been a great way to get some fans that you might never have run into otherwise.
Well, I think the thing that's happening more for you guys than for earlier generations is there's so many ways to make your own audience.
Absolutely.
Be it the street or YouTube, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. There's so many situations where we show up to a bar or a restaurant and we've only got a couple people listening. But when we play on the sidewalks, everyone who stops to listen is fully involved and intentional about being there. And sometimes we'll have 100 people just to come sit and listen to us on the sidewalks who might never have seen us before. So it's just it's a cool thing to do. It's cool to be really interactive with the crowd that you might not have ever seen before or didn't expect to see you.
Well, yeah, I never really looked at it that way, but it's like it's kind of as if everybody who's listening is there for the right reason because
Absolutely.
They heard something and decided
they didn't have to pay to get in, and there's no obligation if they don't like your music.
They're not drinking. They're not there for the booze.
Not always.
You're right. No, but it's been since then. You've found an audience, expanded an audience, and now concerts and recordings and a whole different kind of.
Yeah,
for you.
The live music was always what we've done, and we got really good at street performing. We got really good at always performing just because people would leave if our music wasn't any good in a live context. But we never really focused on the recording side until these last couple years. We had a Kickstarter to fund our previous album, which won the Nahoku Hanahana Award for Alternative Album of the Year, mm-hmm. and then that momentum helped promote our Kickstarter for our third album, which raised $25,000, and we were able to go into the studio and really spend some time honing what we always intended our sound to become.
Which is what? I mean, what kind of sound were you looking for? You have unusual instrumentation.
Absolutely. We've got instruments that make us sound folk, but we always sing pop music.
Uh-huh.
And there's some sort of alternative style that comes through it, so we call ourselves alternative folk pop.
That's as close as any description can be expected to be, I guess.
Yeah, this is it's a wild ride. We're still trying to figure out what exactly that sound is for us, but we're really excited about the third album because we think it represents us more than ever before.
The song you're going to play, is that from the next album?
This is on the new album, which is only available this week on tour. So if you want to come to the performance here at the Atherton, it's one of the very few places that CD is available.
Well, this is Jonathan Franklin and Brian Webb on cello. And what's the song, Jonathan?
This is called The Great Unknown.
You're my runaway satellite in the night. Watch you fly by. If I could only be your shining star, then maybe you might orbit me. But I'm too small to be your gravity, and there's so much life out there. I know I could never bring you down. You are well beyond my atmosphere, so go. Explore the great unknown, but it's a giant leap away from me. Go explore the great unknown, and I will try to find someone in this galaxy light years away. When you look back my way and you wish that I was there. When stars won't lie in deep in space and in time, and you're lost in the last frontier, go explore the great unknown, but it's a giant leap away from me. Go explore the great unknown, and I will try to find someone in this galaxy. Go explore the great unknown, but it's a giant leap away from me. Go explore the great unknown, and I will try to find someone in this galaxy.
That was great. That was great. Jonathan Franklin and Brian Webb from Streetlight Cadence. Sounds as if you learned a lot about songcraft and structuring songs, the way that had different parts, the way the cello part worked in and out.
We've evolved as songwriters after years of going to the Hawaii Songwriters Festival.
Oh, yeah?
And when you have a lot of people who work in the industry criticizing your work, you either take it personally or you do something about it. And at first we took it personally, and then we did something about it. So we hope you like what we're making these days.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And yes, you did something about it. It really sounded great.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
Jonathan Franklin is the lead singer, violinist, and Brian Webb is the cellist with Streetlight Cadence, the four-piece alternative folk pop band that started on the streets of Waikiki and is now based in Southern California. And the band will be playing this Friday in HPR's Atherton studio for a pre-CD release concert. Their newest CD, Beyond Paradise, is due for release next summer.
One, two, three, four. I hold the door as you step on the elevator. Your smile always makes my heart soar. I wanna tell you that we're perfect for each other, but you just got off on the fifth floor. I'm running fast as I can down the staircase. I'm running past all the girls in my way. I catch my breath as I tap on your shoulder.
A little bit more Streetlight Cadence. Throughout the year, you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for news, information, and ideas. We've been there for you, and we count on you to be there for us. We gratefully acknowledge these contributing members for their generous station support. Eileen Marceau of Honolulu, Carol Ann Robitaille of Honoka'a, and Carol Ankrum of Kaunakakai. Now, it could be your turn. Before the end of the year, make your tax-deductible contribution to Hawaii Public Radio. Call us at 955-8821 during business hours or click Donate Now at hawaiipublicradio.org. Prospective growers of medical marijuana are awaiting the Department of Health rules due out on January 4th. One part may mean hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash outlay for entrepreneurs looking to cash in. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
And all this has to do with where this stuff has to be grown, indoors versus out, right?
Well, this is very interesting, a development that I hadn't heard about until Anita Hofschneider talked to some folks, entrepreneurs, trying to get going here in the local med pot business. As you know, we're going to award 8 licenses to grow and sell medical marijuana statewide. But she says it's not clear whether the upcoming rules that are going to come from the Department of Health will preclude using greenhouses to grow the marijuana, rather than having what is described as an enclosed indoor facility. In fact, that's what the rules or the law has called for. So does that mean, can you still have a greenhouse if it's an enclosed indoor facility? And if you can't, well, it could potentially cost as much as $140,000 a month on utility costs. That is exorbitant.
I mean, it's huge and boggling to think about that, but we've got some history behind that, given what California growers are now paying.
Right, and she did look at some of the national statistics. Interestingly enough, nationally, 1% of all electricity use goes for medical marijuana farms and for recreational for those states and others that have that legal. In Denver, where that is the case, they have seen their utility rates go up extraordinarily high. So, but it's very ironic, some of the folks that Anita talked to. Think about it. We're talking about medical marijuana grown in a very, very sunny state that is trying to move forward on renewable energy, you know, get us off of burning fossil fuel. So the irony is certainly out there for a lot of folks, and it's frustrating because if your utility costs are going to exceed your rental cost, that's just probably not going to be a very profitable business.
Or you're going to have to find some way of passing on that cost, and that's not going to be pretty for the people who may need that medical marijuana.
That's exactly right. The cost will be, as it is in any case with electricity costs here in the state, always already the highest in the nation, passed on to the patients. And, of course, these are folks that probably cannot afford it.
So is there any way around this that has been sort of trickling through maybe in the rumor mills about what might be pressed for when we have a legislative session coming up, whether that indoor versus outdoor is going to be jettisoned?
Well, certainly we're going to have to see what the Department of Health does and whether there's some wiggle room in terms of having a greenhouse. Couldn't you have a secure facility? And by the way, this is all about security. That was because there's a lot of law enforcement folks worried that somehow people are going to be able to break in and take that marijuana. But it is very possible that if the Department of Health does not specify or make clear, or rather if it does preclude greenhouses, then it will have to go to the legislature. We can tell you that some lawmakers, folks like Willa Sparrow and Della Albalotti, have already talked about the need to revisit some of those rules. Because, remember, this is brand new, and whenever something new starts out, there's always some tweaking that comes in later sessions. So my guess is we will see some of that in the 2016 session, which is only a month away.
Oh, thank you for that reminder. Okay, that gives us lots to talk about between now and then, and certainly over the next several months afterward. Thanks so much. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
When war comes to your home, who is family?
When I'm in bed at night and my kids crawl in bed with me, I do actually think about the kids who I helped over there and more so the kids who I wasn't able to help.
A Syrian-American doctor goes home after 30 years and confronts that question. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Tonight at 5 is The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, it's not always easy to be happy with your body, no matter what body you've been given, yeah?
Very true, especially around the holiday season. You know, everybody goes to parties and maybe overindulges a little bit. And we're going to talk today about the author of a book who kind of went through a whole series of issues herself and figured out a way to really learn to keep her body healthy, and in doing so, kept herself fit, but maybe not necessarily meeting our standard of what it is to be beautiful in our society. But, you know, beauty only counts if you're healthy along with it.
Yeah, that's right. And our society tends to sell an almost unattainable body image, doesn't it?
Well, sure. You know, none of us are going to look the way we did when we were 17 or 18. And yet those are the ages of a lot of the models that are out there that everybody looks at. So we're going to talk today about the psychological implications of body image, but also the health issues that can occur when people are not necessarily treating their body the way they should, and how eating disorders plays a role in all of this.
And, of course, having a healthy body kind of starts with having a healthy attitude toward it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, if you really appreciate all the different functions that your body has, then you're much more likely to treat it well as opposed to doing things that could be considered abusive to it.
Well, that makes sense. So that's a good opportunity for a lot of people to maybe change their outlook at a critical time, because pretty much everything you get offered during the holidays is not
conducive to... Oh, it's calorie-free, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we're going to talk about today.
Thanks very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Preparation for the coming 2016 legislative session has been going on for a while. Organizations have been working on their agendas, and that would include the Hawaii State Teachers Association. It says it will introduce legislation to create an equally quality-oriented learning experience for all students, preschool through grade 12, regardless of whether kids are in urban or rural schools. Certain core subjects, science and social studies, would be weighted the same as language arts and math. Smaller classroom size would be reduced, and repairs done to schools so they're safe and conducive to learning. And that's just some of their list. To get more of it, we have HSTA President Corey Rosenley on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for making time for us today. Now, you've said that Hawaii needs drastic change in its education system, but Hawaii really isn't known to make wide-ranging, comprehensive educational reform. What makes you think that this 10-part bill will succeed?
Well, you said it exactly. You know, every year we say that education is a priority, yet we continue to do nothing about it. You know, every single year our students are learning in classrooms where their ceilings are leaking, they're drinking out of rusty water fountains, kids are learning in 90-degree-plus classrooms. And we've gotten to a point now where we just basically don't have teachers. We have openings and there's no one to fill them. And at some point we need to say, you know, our kids have to be our priority. We have to invest in our children and our future. And we can't just keep on kicking this can down the road.
The bill seems to say, as you've indicated just a moment ago, you know, we've had enough talk. Hawaii schools need comprehensive action now. And certainly with the GET request to help fund some of those changes, the bill seems to be asking all of Hawaii at some level to participate. Are you really calling out lawmakers and average people to put up or shut up?
Well, we're saying that this is a problem we can no longer ignore. And we've put together, you know, we looked at the best programs from across the world, across the United States. And at this point, we know what's good for education. We know what's good for children. And this plan includes, you know, teaching, bringing back arts education and making sure that kids, when they graduate from high school, can get half of their credits in vocational education so they can get good jobs. We want to make sure that we improve our special education and our ELL programs. And we just want to give our kids a good environment so they're not in these buildings that are falling down in hot classrooms. We want to make sure they have a quality teacher in every classroom. And we want to make sure that every child, regardless of where they are in Hawaii, have access to good schools. These are things that should have happened not just a decade ago, but it should have happened, you know, 100 years ago. And we keep on in Hawaii just ignoring this problem. And eventually, you know, we have to say as a society, if we care about our children, if we believe in investing in the future, then at some point we must make that investment. And it is a very good investment to invest in kids.
In making that investment, you're asking that the GET have a part of it go to funding this, but also to be able to counter that with a tax credit for those people who are in the lowest income rung. Explain that a little bit.
You know, we looked at all sorts of possible taxation, and nothing is perfect. Hawaii is very unique in that we are the only state that doesn't use its property taxes to fund our schools. But the property taxes go to the city and county. You know, the GET was the only real way to potentially fix our schools. A 1% increase in the GET would bring in about $750 million. The biggest problem, though, is regressivity. You know, it affects the poor more than the rich do. So we took out, we increased the food excise tax credit and the renter exemption. So we're able to take away some of that regressivity. But sometimes the biggest regressivity of all is this. A society in which you don't invest in kids, especially poor kids, these are the kids that if they don't get a good education are not going to graduate from high school. And we have thousands of kids that are dropping out of high school or barely getting by high school, will never go to college. They're not finishing high school with a vocational degree. And so that these kids are either going to be waiting for minimum wage jobs or even worse, you know, they won't have any jobs at all and become this, you know, the state has to provide it for them. I mean, sometimes we can't just look at the next year and think about how do we invest in Hawaii. We have to look about the next 10 years. And if we have more kids, and research shows this, if we have more kids graduating high school, getting better jobs, instead of it hurting our economy, research has shown that it improves the economy. And the rest of the world gets this. You know, you look at most industrialized nations, and they make sure that they invest more in poor children than in rich children. And this is not just a Hawaii problem, but an American problem, that we don't do that. So eventually we have to say that, you know, one of the best things you can do in a society is invest in kids, and especially kids that come from, you know, high poverty households.
Let's talk about the other T that is included in the omnibus bill, that of testing. Now, the Every Student Succeeds Act is now law. How much of the HSTA bill reflects the change in national educational policy, especially as we've been talking a lot about testing, which isn't exactly removed from the national law?
So the good thing about the Every Child Succeed Act, it says this. It says that the federal government is no longer going to say to states you have to have teacher evaluations. You have to, you know, punish teachers and schools if they don't do well on the test. It goes as states, you decide what you want to do. And I think this is what this is saying. Basically, we know that a bubble test is not the best way to measure learning. In fact, our children come from very different abilities. So we're trying three different ways in this bill to try to take advantage of this new law. One is we're trying to say that, you know, you cannot punish teachers in schools anymore for the testing. But we're also saying this. Let's start teaching to the whole child. We want it to be, we followed New York's example, and 20% of their time in elementary school has to be spent on the arts, drama, theater, art, music, Hawaiian studies, and Hawaiian language. And we want to do that. And at the high school level, the testing has decimated vocational education. And many of our students can only take a few classes in vocational education instead of being able to graduate with the skills needed so that the next day they can enter the careers. So we're saying we're trying to follow Massachusetts model. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts has this great way of making sure that kids, when they leave high school, can start working as auto mechanics or working in construction or working culinary. So we're trying to teach to the whole child.
In some ways, and we have to go very quickly now because we're going to have to leave in a second, though, but it sounds as if we are reverting back to a way in which kids were allowed to find their own path, or maybe in some cases, you know, put down certain paths based on how they fit into an educational system. Once upon a time where there were a lot of vocational, or there was a lot of attention paid to vocational classes, and then that went away with the idea that every kid should be going to college. Are we trying to normalize that a little bit more now in what you presented?
What research shows is that our kids have many different abilities. You know, I may be very good at writing an essay, but please don't ask me to fix a car. But some of these students that can get, go to high school and learn how to fix a car, they can have a good life, make a good salary, and be happy in what they're doing. We shouldn't try to say that all children fit into one mold. In fact, the best thing we can do is take what a child is good at and help them reach what they want in their lives. And this is one of the things we're trying to do with this bill.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you, and we'll be watching this bill carefully.
Thank you so much.
Corey Rosenlee is the president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a beautiful valley on Hawaii Island that's rich in historical and natural significance. It was once a favorite home to Ali'i and is still thought of as the Valley of the Kings. It's been inhabited for hundreds of years and was once a rich source of historical artifacts from the days before contact, but many of those were wiped out in the 1946 tsunami that penetrated deep into the valley. You can still see debris from the tsunami's leading edge in the valley, far from the shoreline. It's a place of soaring cliffs, spectacular waterfalls, and a beautiful black sand beach popular with visitors and locals. This morning we asked you if you could tell us its name, which is Waipio Valley.
And Kalia Kelmelson knew that, called in from the North Shore of Maui, and we'll get the t-shirt. Followed very quickly by Gail Smart, also from the Big Island, from the Big Island, and we just wish you'd call a little sooner, maybe she could have been the winner, too.
The race was on, right?
The race is always on. But anyway,
right.
We love it when you play, and thanks very much. And good to know what people know in our state.
That's right.
And now at 8:45, that's the end of today's quiz. If you have one for a future date, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Annie Camilla from Mango Season. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org. You're listening to member-supported HPR2, live on the web at hpr2.org.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in our massive universe around our very small planet. And as usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, for this week's report. Hey, Christopher, what's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter can be seen in the dawn sky. The three planets appear very bright and should be very easy to spot. Now, the moon is waxing and will be well on the way to being full by week's end.
Now, we're going to be, revisiting in some ways and updating a story that we have previously covered about a journey into the asteroid belt.
That's right. We're returning to the asteroid belt this week and to its largest member object, the dwarf planet Ceres, which is about 600 miles in diameter. NASA's Dawn spacecraft caused quite a stir when it began sending back detailed images of the surface of Ceres a few months ago. These images showed clusters of very bright spots within deep craters. These unexplained bright patches stirred all kinds of debate as to what their nature may actually be.
And before we get into that exciting revelation, just for a size comparison, the size of Ceres compared with Pluto?
Now, to put that in perspective for our listeners, Pluto is about 1,400 miles in diameter, so a little bit over twice the size of Ceres.
I guess it would be the moon, then, that puts this into greater perspective, right? Because the moon is bigger than Pluto, right?
That's right. It's bigger than Pluto and Ceres combined.
Okay, so back to these mysterious lights that we had been talking about on Ceres. There had been some strange theories about what it could be. It could be ice, maybe some other stuff, right?
Yes, there were all kinds of ideas floating around out there, some of them more far out than others. However, after several months of investigation, we may have finally solved the mystery of Ceres spots. They may actually be huge deposits of salt. And this salt is thought to have formed when minerals in the rock mixed with water ice at the bottom of the craters.
Wow. This is because scientists suspect there may be a saltwater ocean within Ceres?
That's right. But as it turns out, things may be a little bit more complicated on Ceres than we previously thought. While this does not confirm an ocean directly, it does mean that we will have to look twice as hard to discover what's really going on under Ceres spots.
Can't we just send a big drill up there?
You really could if you could afford it.
It's Christopher Phillips from Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee and another fascinating Stargazer report. Thank you.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Most of us have felt excluded at one time or another, and children can be cruel to kids who are seen as different. Maui-based novelist Arlie Holmes has fashioned a novel that looks at the world through the eyes of just such a child and finds redemption and inspiration for others in his story. His novel, the first in a planned trilogy, is called Daddy Will Fix It, and he's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Arlie.
Good morning.
Could you give us sort of a summary of the story of your book?
It is fiction, but there are true stories mixed in throughout the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes some of the true stories are actually, I can remember very vividly. I wrote this novel. It's set in rural Appalachia, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
in the 1950s, which I'm a little bit younger than that. But I had an inspiration of a movie that I saw one time that many of you may or may not have seen, and that was called Coal Miner's Daughter.
Oh, sure.
And I thought that rural Appalachia, Virginia, the depressing era would be very romantic. So I said it a little bit earlier than actually in reality happened. But when I wrote the novel, I was a little bit concerned that it may be only people in Appalachia, Virginia, in the West Virginia, Pennsylvania area could only relate to it. But I was very much shocked whenever it came out. Because I get phone calls, Facebook phone calls, I get emails from Australia, from Santiago, Chile, from Belgium, that everybody can relate to it because of the little Sammy character, the main character in the book. Sammy strived his whole life to try to win acceptance. He was a gifted artist, and no matter what he did, he just was overshadowed. And he gave his whole life just trying to be accepted. And the New York Times, they even made comments about my characters being rich and well-developed.
Arlie,
go ahead, sorry.
You taught around the world, right?
I taught graphic arts programs around the world. I was an international graphic arts instructor for textiles.
Was that where you got some of the stories? That's where you saw some of these behaviors in action?
Honestly, anybody that's ever felt, like an outcast or felt like they couldn't measure up can relate to it. When we're kids, we feel like we always want to be chosen first on the team, but somehow we get the butterflies in our belly and we just are chosen last. But every one of us has that little self-esteem issue, self-doubt issues in there. And I did travel the world, but this was before the novel was created.
Well, how does Sammy find his particular way out?
His grandmother, this part is fiction. His grandmother inherits a lot of money. And in the book, I wanted Sammy to inherit a lot of money. And how does an 18-year-old child have a lot of money unless he inherits money? So Sammy, because he feels left out, wants to help others. And that's the way I actually feel myself. Sammy opens a homeless shelter in New York City to help other people out. So writing, I find, is a very therapeutic release, to express yourself. Anyway, but Sammy just wants to strive to be noticed and to help other people. Sammy is never one that thinks of himself first. He always thinks of others first.
Well, Arlie, what did you draw from in your own life to create this character? The rural environment?
I actually was raised in South Carolina. I was born in Virginia. And when I went to visit my grandparents in Virginia, I noticed the poverty. And of course, all areas of the country and the world have poverty. But I just was enthralled with my grandmother, the life that she led. And she's one of the central characters in the book. And I call her Granny Ruth in the book. Granny Ruth is the only one that really sees Sammy for who Sammy is, somebody that's just a gifted artist that wants to help other people. So my main inspiration for the setting was my grandmother in the novel.
Do you think there are an awful lot of people out there who have a gifted artist inside them and just for one reason or another haven't brought it out?
Of course. I find that not just me and not just currently, but all artists, whether it be an author, a poet, a painter, or any other art form, we all have this need to prove ourselves, or sometimes the best poetry or the best writing comes out of depression. I don't know if you've heard the expression, great art comes through great suffering. Mm-hmm. So I think that all artists, the novelists, poets, anything has that all in common with each other.
Well, and in a way, since suffering is something that's likely to come our way no matter what,
that's right.
It kind of takes the sting out of it if we can make it into something, doesn't it?
That's true. The Daddy Will Fix It, the one that was released in April, is the first in the trilogy. The second novel, I Believe in Me, is about Sammy redemption of himself. And I'm writing the third novel now. It is a trilogy. And the third novel is about the writing of the first novel. I have been approached already about turning the first novel into a screenplay. I don't know if that will happen or not, but I cannot do the screenplay yet until I finished writing all three books because of a commitment to the publisher.
Well, Arlie, we better let you get back to work, but I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks for talking with us this morning.
And I will be at Barnes & Noble this Sunday from 1 to 5.
That's what I hear.
Lahaina, Maui.
Arlie Holmes is the author of Daddy Will Fix It, the first novel in a planned trilogy, and at Barnes & Noble in Lahaina, he'll be there this Sunday, as he said.
Thank you. I'm going to take it from them.
Yes, sir.
Seize it.
Yes, sir.
The new film, Beasts of No Nation, is about young boys forced into being soldiers serving a warlord in an unnamed African country. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's director, Cary Fukunaga, who also directed the first season of True Detective. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
We had a lot on the show about averting crises, whether it was talking about what happens during childhood and kids who feel that they are being ostracized and what may happen to them later in life, as you talked about with Arlie just a moment ago, or certainly looking at our environment and what may also happen with education policy changing in Hawaii.
Well, you know, just in historical terms, awareness of the environment and Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and all that followed, that's a very recent thing in our history compared to how long we've been messing up the environment. Our awareness of it is really only just now growing, and we're finding out more all the time.
Well, so we hear from Dr. Sandra Steingraber, who we talked to a little earlier this morning, and she's going to be here in Honolulu on Wednesday, and she's going to make a lot more of those connections based on her view of science and what she's been documenting since the release of her first book in 1997.
Well, those connections are there to be made, as she said.
Well, we'll see how those connections connect to us. And we will make the connection to you tomorrow when we come back to join you for another run of the conversation. We'll be talking with retiring HCDA Executive Director Anthony Ching, and we'll see what benediction he has for his agency.
And we'll be bringing in special guests this week for some live holiday music.
We like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like. It's available 24/7 to leave your comments at 808-792-8217. If you like email, that's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or get to me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of the conversation.